Okay, good morning, members. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Lindsay, will you please take the roll?
Yes, happy to. Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner. Lead Albright.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Representative Frederick. Representative Hansen. Representative Keel. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Robbins is on her way. Representative Sandel.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher. I don't think we have a quorum yet, Representative Schultz, but if we're not voting.
Okay, let me know when we have a quorum. So thank you, members. So we won't, I won't move the minutes until we have a quorum. So we'll go back to that. So members, we're going to take, I'm going to move House File 2127, so it's in front of the committee. And today we're going to continue our discussion on the governor's budget bill. We're going to first take testimony to make sure we can get to all the testifiers, and then we'll have Mr. Greenman from DHS walk us through the spreadsheets, and members can ask specific questions about the budget and fiscal items in the spreadsheet. And then tomorrow, members, we're going to meet at 10:30. And we're going to take up, I believe we have five bills. We're going to be adding House File 1159 to the agenda tomorrow, and it will have an amendment, and that will be posted soon. This is the bill that funds parents and spouses as PCAs that we had extended through February 7th, and that has expired. I'm sure there's bipartisan support for that, so we're going to hear that amendment and hopefully send it to Ways and Means and to the floor. So, and then we're going to hear four other bills that we're going to be sending to the floor or laying over for possible inclusion. And House File 2127, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So let's start. And also Friday, we're going to have a joint hearing with Health, Finance, and Policy Committee at 3 o'clock. And we're going to talk about the American Recovery Act. So we're going to have MMB there and other experts talk about the implications for health and human services area from the federal stimulus bill. And that's not a required hearing, but it will be a joint hearing with the members on the Health Finance Committee. So I hope members will attend and ask questions and get an overview of that ARP initiative. So let's go to testifiers first on House File 2127 as amended. The first testifier I have is Christy Claudio. I hope you're here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Chair Schultz, member of the committee. My name is Christy Caes Claudio. I have two last names. I live in Minneapolis. I am a member of SEIU Healthcare of Minnesota Home Care Workers. Please support the budget. It was ratified or contact. Instead of reviewing all the details, I will talk about the impact of my life. I have been a home care worker for over 20 years, since high school. For me, caregiver is more than a job, it's my calling. Currently, I am a direct support professional for my son with developmental delays. Also, I have been a caregiver for other people before. My original plan wasn't really caregiver for my own son. I wanted to hire someone else. I wanted to give him like sense of independence that also he needs beyond a normal kid. At least he will have someone external with him, that he will not be with mom 24/7. And originally, he was on PCA choice. But under PCA choice, it was hard to hire anyone because PCA are underpaid. And they don't have enough benefits. I am a person that also have disabilities now, that in the future might need PCA services. So sometimes I wonder what will happen with our family if I end up needing the services and I cannot take care of my own son. So please, again, support the budget that will ratify the contract. Increase the pay for PCA. And I will thank all of you for the bipartisan support and all the co-authors of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Case, Claudia, for your testimony and being with us this morning. The second testifier I have is Pang Bang. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pang Bang. I am the treasurer of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance, a statewide membership association for personal care assistant providers. And I also run a minority-owned PCA agency, Rainbow Healthcare, located here in St. Paul. The Minnesota First Provider Alliance is very concerned by the revised budget released on March 18, 2021 by Governor Tim Walz. The underfunding of the PCA rate puts the 44,000 people with disabilities and older adults who rely on this service in jeopardy of losing their service provider in the middle of a pandemic. This is a matter of simple economics. We cannot pay employees $15 an hour and cover their paid time off in Minneapolis and St. Paul, or the $15.25 wage that is in the collective bargaining agreement, plus benefits if the state only reimburses us $19.08 an hour. The math just doesn't work. And how does DHS expect a provider who gets just $19.08 an hour to pay $42 for each employee background study? A few points that I wanted to share. Of the 871 PCA provider agencies in the state, we know that 233 are located in Minneapolis and 143 are in St. Paul. As stated by Assistant Commissioner Gertrude Matamba-Matusa in this committee last week, quote, our ultimate goal is to make sure that providers stay in business, and if we are paying a rate that is below what it takes to cover the cost of providing those services, then we end up with a system that has no providers, and so that doesn't serve anyone, end of quote. We are at a crisis point, and the underfunding of the PCA program will likely result in the closure of many traditional PCA agencies in Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as PCA choice agencies statewide. Smaller, culturally specific agencies will be hardest hit. And as a result, members of the Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities will lose their ability to receive services from culture-specific providers who speak their language. This is crucial since of the approximately 44,000 people who access the PCA program, 62% are individuals who are BIPOC. The Provider Alliance calls on the Minnesota legislature to pass a data-driven, cost-based rate framework included in House File 663 and to fund the PCA program at a level that supports the minimum wage obligations in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and those under the tentative CBA. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fang, and please hang out for, we may have questions from members, and we'll do that after we go through all the testifiers. The next testifier is Jen Stella. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Shelton, committee members. My name is Jen Stella. I'm the Director of Operations for Park Avenue Center. Since 1979, we've provided evidence-based drug and alcohol treatment in South Minneapolis with three treatment facilities and 127 beds for free supervised offsite lodging. We have about 180 staff members, and we serve over 5,000 clients annually, clients who struggle with multiple barriers, including mental illness, homelessness, and legal issues. We stand in opposition to the governor's proposed budget related to substance use disorders for the following reasons. It mandates providers into what had been a voluntary federal demonstration project. It proposes cuts to provider enhanced rates, and it places bureaucratic caps on what should be clinical decisions made by trained licensed professionals and providers. At Park Avenue Center, cutting enhanced rates means that we'll be unable to pay for our licensed mental health staff who help clients work through their illness. It means we won't be able to pay for our nurses who help clients with their medications and other medical needs, and we won't be able to pay for our dietitians who teach clients about the importance of nutrition and eating healthy on a very limited budget. In short, it means the quality of care that we provide will be greatly reduced. The proposed cap in hours goes against evidence-based best practices by limiting the amount of services available to clients and by requiring providers to obtain prior authorization as suggested in the revised budget, goes against the CMS requirement of direct access into treatment. We're in a national crisis when it comes to mental illness and addiction. For the last year, our industry's workers have been told that they're essential. Now is not the time to take away clinical decision-making, funding, and imperative resources. Therefore, we're asking the committee to continue to work with MARCH and other stakeholders to incorporate their proposed reasonable solutions, which calls for a ramp to onboarding the demo, leaving the enhanced rates in effect until the restructuring of rates is complete, and using the one-time federal dollars designated for substance use disorder to create an evidence-based, patient-centered, fully integrated behavioral health continuation of care. Thank you for the time to testify, Chair Schultz and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Stella. The next testifier is Tim Walsh. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Tim Walsh. Thank you, Chair Schultz and members. Tim Walsh, Vice President of Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge and also representing MARCH. And I'd like to amplify what Jen just reported to you. Right now, the budget deletes Minnesota Statute 254B.05, Subdivision 5, which are rate enhancements for complexity in substance use disorder treatment. And I want to get really specific about who that harms. That harms communities of color, Indigenous Americans, people with serious mental health and substance use disorders, women with children, and people with medical complexity, which means that they have significant medical issues. As you can imagine, to be a provider and provide treatment for these populations requires a much level, higher level of care and complexity. And if you eliminate these enhanced rates, providers will be forced to reduce our level of services and quality services to this population. And to be very specific, our field has only received a cut of 1.5% net over the last 10 years. Our participation in the waiver that Jen referred to will generate $77 million by my calculations over each biennium for the Department of Human Services. And even though we are doing this and participating in a historic reform to the substance use disorder field at this time, they are actually recommending to you cutting rate enhancements for us during this time. So what this would mean, DHS would say we're going to get an increase for participating in the waiver. That would be about $27 per day per client, which sounds pretty good. But then you minus $11 per rate enhancement for these populations that I just talked about. So for some providers, we will get a $5 per day increase for clients. And then for some providers, that means that they will actually get a cut of $6 per day per client because of the reduction in the rate enhancements. I just have to say this is the absolute worst time to be reducing these services to these communities and to these folks with these higher levels of needs and complexity. And I just, please, do not delete 254B05 subdivision 5. Please retain the rate enhancements. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh, for your testimony. Please stick around for questions.
Will do.
The next testifier is Mary Rail. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair Schultz and committee members, thank you. My name is Mary Rail. I'm the executive director at Midland National Center, where I've been for the last 24 years. Midland is a nonprofit residential and outpatient substance use disorder treatment provider located in Loretto. And if you don't know where Loretto is, it's in western Hennepin County. Since 1990, Vinland has provided drug and alcohol addiction treatment for people with cognitive disabilities, as Tim just spoke about, we're one of those ones that have the enhanced rates. We're the only treatment provider in the state that meets the Department of Human Services and the American Society of Addiction Medicine's 3.3 level of care, which means we serve clients from all over the state of Minnesota. Since May of 2018, Vinland has been one of the initial nine providers involved in the Minnesota Department of Human Services trials to get the demonstration grant off the ground. I have remained and am still a huge proponent of this grant. There are many components to the 1115 grant, but the SED reform is not part of this budget. These reforms were part of previous year's legislation, and we are required to provide those services as they are addressed today. The financial impact of this budget is what I want to make you aware of. Throughout the last 3 years, the grant has been hailed as a voluntary project that included a 15% increase for residential and a 10% increase for outpatient services. Not once has anyone at DHS indicated that it would become a requirement to participate or that DHS would eliminate the complexity rates for services provided that may or may not be included in the 1115 structure. They contend that these services are not provided through the grant. While that is true for the co-occurring and medical services, there's not a reciprocal increase for providers to staff for required medical and mental health professionals, and it's definitely not a requirement for special populations and clients with children. In fact, if a residential program offered all four of the complexity rates, the 15% rate increase and the elimination of the complexities would actually reduce their rate by 4%. The proposed budget changes would reduce the revenue that Vinland budgeted by over $400,000 annually. Vinland has spent years taking steps and expending the resources necessary to meet the heightened provider statements, including the 1115 waiver, only now to find out that the increased reimbursement associated with those improvements has been pulled out from under us. Balancing the state's SED budget with funding that was promised to providers is just wrong. By not eliminating the complexity rates, the state and counties will still see a decrease in SED treatment costs for residential providers with more than 16 beds. The federal reimbursement will go to 94% rather than the current zero. There are many SED providers that have been hard hit by decreased censuses and increased costs associated with COVID. These proposed changes may be the end of their ability to continue to provide services to those individuals that need treatment. As you are well aware, in the midst of the mental health crisis and opioid epidemic, combined with a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, we need more access to treatment providers in the state of Minnesota, not less. I urge you to remove the elimination of the four complexity rates in this budget so we can continue to help those it so desperately needs. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Rail, for your testimony. The last testifier I have is Michael Dobb. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair Schultz and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to participate today. My name is Michael Daub. I'm a member of the March Government Affairs Committee. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of Wayside Recovery Center in St. Louis Park. I'm here today to oppose the SUD reform proposal in Article 2, Sections 3, 7, and 8 of House File 2127. I am here to support March's framework of alternatives. I would like to offer you some background about how we've reached the point where we're at today. In 2017, Mercer Government Human Services Consulting was commissioned by the DHS to conduct a study to analyze Minnesota's SUD treatment models and payment methods, and to identify recommendations for alternative payment models. In November 2018, the Minnesota Study of Substance Use Disorder Reimbursement, which we call the Mercer Report, was published. The SUD reform proposal flies in the face of the Mercer Report, which anticipated the difficulty mandating implementation of the SUD demonstration on a statewide basis, stating, and I quote, "The expectation of a single provider expanding to provide the entire array of SM levels of care under the proposed SUD demonstrations was not realistic. One provider was very direct in stating their confusion over this expectation. There's no way we can provide all of the ASAM levels of care. It is unreasonable to ask us to do that. State staff explained that the demonstration will only affect providers who opt into the program to test the effectiveness of a full continuum of care, page 43 of the Mercer report. I join with others and indicate that until the SUD reform proposal came out, it was clear their participation would be discretionary, not mandatory. It was also clear that participants would receive a rate increase without a cut of the rate enhancements. In conclusion, the SUD reform proposal will endanger statewide access to effective SUD treatment. It conflicts with the stated goal of the Mercer report to deliver quality care when and where individuals need it, and to ensure that providers can invest in best practices for diverse and changing populations with complex conditions and increasingly intensive needs. It will impair a sustainable SUD system because it will jeopardize service capacity and geographic access in rural areas. The reform proposal is a bad idea at the wrong time. It reflects continuing stigmatization of people seeking recovery from substance use disorders. It's time for that to end. You can draw the line here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dobb. Let's open it up for member questions since we've gone through the list of testifiers. Do we have questions from members? We've heard a lot of testimony about the governor's proposal for the SUD's enhanced rates. I don't know if Chair Fisher wants to add anything to these comments. I know he's been doing a lot of work with MARCH and these various groups.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, last night, Representative Franke, myself, met with DHS and MARCH to hear a number of concerns that were highlighted here. And I think it's important for folks to know that the original proposal that was put out by the governor was done at a time when we were facing a $1.6 billion deficit. And I know that as we've been working with DHS, there's a lot of new opportunities that they have now that we're not facing that deficit anymore, and taking a look at how can we reinvest any savings that were being saved or the new dollars coming in, and trying to meet some of the concerns out there. And I think that we'll have some more information that I'll be able to share with you, Chair, within the next day or so. But I think there is, from what I'm seeing and from what Representative Franke was seeing as we were talking last night afterwards, is that we think there's some real opportunities to meet a number of concerns that we heard addressed today, and at the same time making sure that we're improving the overall system that will be delivering these services in the future. So I can provide that information to everyone at this point in time that we are clearly hearing what MARCH has to say, and the Department of Human Services is very much engaged in wanting to make steps to make sure that we have a program that is very viable in the future.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, and thank you for working with all the stakeholders and getting to a solution. I have a question for either Mr. Dobb or Mr. Walsh or both. I'm just wondering, once we started paying enhanced rates, were we able to provide more services and more different types of services for those with higher acuity? Mr. Walsh?
The short answer, Chair Schultz, is yes. So for instance, just let's take specifically co-occurring treatment rates. So at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, we provide diagnostic assessments, individual therapy, group psychoeducation. That's all over and above actually what's required under the standards that are in our licensing statute. And the same can be said with people with serious mental health issues, medical complexity, women with children, and the other areas. Every single one of us who provide these enhanced services and with increasing complexity, then we have enhanced services to meet those needs. And if these enhanced rates go away, we will have to reduce those services to these specific populations.
Thank you for that, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Dobb, did you want to comment on that?
No, I think Tim Walsh covered it very nicely. Thank you.
Thank you. And my second question is, are for-profit facilities, treatment facilities, are they eligible for the waiver grants under this new proposal, Mr. Dobb or Mr. Walsh?
Chair Schultz, the answer to that is yes. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members to the testifiers? Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and representatives. A question, I guess, for Representative Fisher. To the conversations that you had last night, do you think that the governor's new budget, which I think has been discussed in a couple of other committees, is going to be able to provide the support that's necessary for the services that Mr. Walsh and Mr. Dalva talk about, and when we have a chance, and when we have a chance in our committee to discuss them and understand them?
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, Representative Sandel. I do think that the dollars will be out there. I know that we heard in committee earlier this week, the governor's revision, and one of the things that we saw in the revision, instead of booking any savings, and the savings that were being booked before was from this program, they're no longer booking those as savings. What they're looking at is reinvesting those in. They did not provide any great detail when we were talking to them in committee, but those are some of the things is that is being fleshed out in the discussions that we have going on right now to make sure that we are making sure that those populations that need those additional services. And as an example is when you're working with a person who has children, the children need childcare so that the person can receive treatment. You want to make sure that those re-enhanced, those rates are coming through so that the person doesn't have to worry about who's taking care of my kids, where are my kids, you know, or skipping a meeting altogether because they don't have care for the kids. You know, this is some of these wraparound things that are really critical that we want to make sure that we don't lose in the process. So these are part of the broader discussions of how to make sure that we don't lose these enhancements, but at the same time, make sure that we end up in a situation where it is something that as we're going forward, we're able to expand the programs out there, because I think as we change the rate structure, we'll see more providers out there, which will increase the opportunity for more people to receive services than do now. And I think that's a critical part of the equation, is making sure that we've got the capacity coming into the system to take care of the needs, because the needs are much greater out there than we have capacity for right now.
Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Representative Fisher and Madam Chair. I have just one more question to Mr. Walsh, and that is a teen and adult challenge. What's your population, and how are people served, and how are they able to then go out again and live independently?
Mr. Walsh.
Good. Yes. Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative. So Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge has 13 facilities across the state of Minnesota. We provide licensed residential treatment, and that's approximately 250 clients on a daily basis. And that's anywhere up to 90 days of licensed residential treatment. But then we also provide housing for people who need that. And we provide supportive housing, which means that we provide psychiatric care, mental health treatment, along with that nursing care, treatment coordination, peer recovery support services, all the wraparound services that have been referenced thus far. And so we serve over 700 people per day. Then we have outpatient services across the state for people who only need that level of care. And then we have a prevention program that reaches 60,000 middle schoolers and high schoolers per year called Know the Truth. So we have a fairly complete continuum of services.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Chair. And thanks to all the testifiers for the really important work. I certainly appreciate it and admire it. Thank you.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard one of the testifiers, I'm not sure which one, talking about how this proposal impacts equity. And I'd like a little more detail about that, other than that we're talking about medical assistance, which, you know, obviously medical assistance serves a more diverse population than the whole Minnesota population. Whoever was talking about that. Could you be more specific about how this impacts minority populations and that why you're saying that this in particular impacts equity?
I believe thank that's you. Mr. Walsh. Mr. Walsh?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Liebling. Yes, to be very specific, and first of all, I need to say that I'm of Native American ancestry and I currently have family from the Fond du Lac Indian Reservation. So this act actually has a personal impact as well. So I need to say that. But so when we talk about special populations, that's a euphemism for communities of color. That includes programs that serve specifically African American clients. It means those that serve indigenous populations and Native Americans. And so let's not speak in euphemisms. We're talking about some of the people who have been the most disadvantaged, the most vulnerable, the most affected by COVID, social unrest, and so on. So let's be very specific about that. And then we'd say use the euphemism special population. That's when Vinland was talking about special. Well, what does that mean? That means people with really serious mental health issues and serious substance use disorder issues. And then you added women with children. Of course, women with children, almost always what we're talking about there is people who are economically disadvantaged. You're also talking about people of color there. And then also, of course, as we know, also these other populations have significant medical issues. And so I was even struggling whether to say this or not, but I'm going to say it. I think, you know, if we're talking about principled discussions about budget and the two principles are equity and inclusion, these rate cuts fail on both of those principles.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Chair Liebling?
Well, thank you for that. I guess I was hoping for something a little bit more specific about how these enhancements are being used to serve those populations. Maybe you could provide that in writing. That would be helpful because, you know, I appreciate that. You know, anything we do in medical assistance, anything we do in our public programs, at some level, probably, well, you know, we serve a lot of our population of color disproportionately are in going to be in that group. But that doesn't mean that everything, you know, we are all trying to focus more on reaching those populations of color and having true health equity in this state. We know that. We know that, you know, racism is a public health crisis. We know that. And so we really want to get our arms around that. And I just, I want to understand this better, how it focuses on that. So if you could provide that later on, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Will do.
Mr. Walsh, thank you.
Will do.
Mr. Walsh, do you have reports on your success with the populations you serve in terms of outcomes, however you measure those?
Yeah,
and
yes,
do you provide those? Then I'm assuming you provide those to our agencies?
We certainly would. And just if you want me to just cover very quickly, we've done 3 studies with the University of Minnesota. And we can actually demonstrate how the brain changes through our services. So we have those studies. We also have done 3 studies through the Wilder Foundation. And of course, that is, I would say, the most respected social science agency in the state. And we've been able to demonstrate that people who complete both our short-term licensed residential treatment plus our housing with supports program, if they graduate both of those, that 67% do not relapse. And 13% have a lapse and then return to full-time sobriety. And we're also able to demonstrate improved outcomes in housing, employment, self-sufficiency, social networks. We're able to demonstrate all of those positive outcomes through these kinds of approaches. So thank you for asking that question.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. And with the enhanced rate, did your outcomes improve?
Yes, that is how we enhance our services, is through the enhanced rate. That is exactly correct.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Any other questions from members for the testifiers? Okay, I'm not seeing any raised hands. Well, I want to thank the testifiers for joining us today and for giving their testimony and for advocating for this issue and for their organizations. So members, now we're going to move on to the presentation from DHS. We have Mr. Greenman here, and I don't know if we want to share the screen with the spreadsheet, but I'll leave that up to Mr. Greenman. And this is an opportunity for members to look at the fiscal cost or savings from the governor's initiatives in the human services jurisdiction. So Mr. Greenman, are you with us? There you are. Welcome to the back to the committee, and just state your name for the record. And maybe before we have questions, just give a very high level overview of the spreadsheet or certain items, especially those that we've talked about today. Mr. Greenman.
Morning, Madam Chair. Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I'll share my screen. This is a tracking document that the department prepares for the governor's budget, and we'll also be filling in what this shows is if you look on the left side, there's a list of rows, so you can track along with what I'm talking about. What this shows is for fiscal years 21 and 22, it actually starts in fiscal year 21, where the budget is for fiscal years 22 and 23. And then it includes planning information for fiscal years 24 and 25 as part of the governor's budget. It also includes some appropriations in fiscal year 21 that are meant to help fund some activities before July 1st. What this document does is it shows the cost of services for general fund spending, and that as well as spending out of other funds. So if you look on line 44, it's got the total Department of Human Services spending for the governor's budget. And this, I should note, this does include Representative Schultz's committee, Representative Liebling's, and Representative Pinto's combined. And so if you look along line 45, you'll see that the general fund target or the general fund spending for the governor in fiscal years 22 and 23 is about $182 million. If you add in what we're also spending in fiscal year 21 from the general fund, it comes out to a target of about a positive $200 million from the general fund as part of the governor's budget. And then there's additional spending from the TANF fund as well, some small savings from the healthcare access fund. And there's some federal funds and other statutory dollars that are spent as well. So what I'm planning to do is walk through the bolded items, the bolded rows of the proposals that apply to this committee. Below those numbers, if you look on line 101, you see the first proposal is an HCBS equity evaluation. And then the line below that refers to the general fund fiscal impact. And because the fiscal impact is entirely in the general fund, the numbers on rows 101 and 102 match. Below those lines, there are three additional lines that provide additional information, and you'll see this with all of the proposals. This is detailed tracking that Mr. Berg and the Senate staff will use to actually fill in, populate the appropriations article with the amounts that we're spending for those items. And so I'll start to go through the spreadsheets. And if people have questions, I'm happy to answer. And I have lots of friends with me today to help if I get in trouble. So the first item that's in front of this committee is line 101. It's the HCBS equity evaluation. This is this proposal has a general fund cost of $289,000. It's a one-time cost. This is a proposal that would study, we have a contract with a vendor to evaluate the policies and practices that have prevented or created barriers to people of color accessing home and community waste waiver services. And it would also include an FTE that would pay for, that would manage the contract with the vendor, would do some evaluation work and write up a final report with recommendations for the legislature on those activities. The second item is a new item with the governor's revised budget. This proposal has two components. Actually, it's more than two components, but the two main components are requires that after a nursing facility enrollee resident completes a therapy assessment or comes out of a COVID isolation, that person needs to be reassessed once they get back to sort of normal activities to determine what their appropriate rate should be for that population, rather than keep them on the higher rate that they had when they were in the receiving the therapy services or in the COVID isolation. And this is projected to result in a savings to the state because we're no longer going to be paying for higher rates for services that somebody is no longer receiving.
Mr. Greenman, could we, I need to remind members that they can go to the full screen view and that can enlarge the spreadsheet. Otherwise, Mr. Greenman, are you able to make it a little bit larger for members? But in your upper right-hand side screen, members, if you go to view and you can go to full screen, it will also enlarge.
I can try. I'm not sure exactly how to do that, but I see. Is that better?
That's better. Thank you, Mr. Greenman.
So
you have a question, Chair Liebling?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment that Ms. Vang, the CA for this committee, sent this out again to members separately. And so if any members like me are working on two screens, you can open it on your own as well. And I just find that a lot easier. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Go ahead, Mr. Greenman.
So the second part of this nursing facility proposal is to add additional staff to do audits of the nursing facility cost-based reimbursement system. And this is something we would propose to do to make sure that the rates we're paying are both adequate and not overly high. And so we believe that this is it's important to do both of these pieces of the proposal, both the reassessments and the audits of nursing facility rates to make sure that we're paying the right amounts and that private pay consumers are paying the right amounts as well. The next proposal is actually not part of, not actually coming through this committee, but it's got a cost implications for this committee. It's the paid family medical leave proposal. It includes costs for systems work that DHS has to do because the amounts that people get paid for through this paid family leave proposal are counted against income, are counted against the income guidelines for various programs administered by DHS. So there's a number of systems projects that have to happen to change our IT system so we can start to count those dollars. And then there's also, because nursing facilities would be expected to comply with this new law, they would incur additional costs to pay for the leave, and those costs would eventually get built into their rates. So there is a medical assistance cost, but not until fiscal year 2025. And the cost is actually all borne by it's not a general fund cost. It comes out of the paid family medical leave fund, or I believe there's a fund created in the bill. The next proposal is in Representative Pinto's committee. The following one on line 130, this is the Family First Prevention Services Act proposal. This is involves a number of investments that the state has to pay for helping counties, helping providers get to the point where we're able to provide services that are eligible for Title IV-E reimbursement. There's a big change coming October 1st of 2021 regarding services that are provided to children in out-of-home placement. And we want to be sure we're getting our services sort of modernized or transitioned to meet the federal standards. So there's a lot of staff starting in children or child's safety and permanency is adding a number of staff around training and prevention to try to make sure that we're ready to get started. We've got some staff starting in background studies to do additional background studies to make sure there's compliance with the law. And then there's certain licensing requirements that we need to meet. So we're adding some staff for those. This is a federal compliance proposal. It's necessary to get the funding so that the counties can continue to receive the Title IV-E, which are child protection dollars that the feds provide us. We want to continue to be eligible for those funds. And so this is what that investment is for. The next proposal is North Star Care for Children Federal. It's federal requirements. Previously, the department or the state had a law that the North Star, I should go step back. The North Star program provides cash assistance to families who are providing foster care, adoption, or kinship care to children. And it's a forecasted program. And what we had a statute in state law that basically reduced the amount of North Star benefits that a family would receive based on receipt of certain federal funds. I think some of them had to do with survivor's disability, black lung disease, a couple other ones. We were told by the federal government that law was in place since 2015. We were told in 2019 by the federal government that we cannot do that. That was not, that's out of compliance with federal law. So we have since changed our practices. And so now we're not reducing benefits based on those particular federal benefits. Instead, what we're doing is we're not counting them. What this proposal does is it goes back to 2015 and readjusts the payments that we have to make to those families so that we're no longer reducing their benefits based on income received from those federal benefits, from the federal programs. The next proposal, CF48, is a program that the department is working on with the University of Minnesota Duluth, and it's been put together with a number of tribal human service agencies as well. What this is going to do is provide training to counties on making sure that when there's work being done for child welfare services with children that are part of tribal nations, that the work is compliant with both the federal ICWA law and then the state law, the accompanying state law, to make sure that American Indian children are being treated in accordance with those laws. And so this would create a training program to make sure that all county staff are trained on how to approach these cases and how to resolve them in compliance with federal law and state law. Line 147 is a federal compliance issue. It has to do with our SNAP error rate. I think this might have been discussed in the last several days in this committee, if I'm not mistaken. What this does is it makes a number of changes to our MAXIS system. We have error rates in our medical assistance program or our SNAP program where we provide somebody with either too much or too little in the way of benefits. What this would do is and because we have an error rate that is exceeding the federal error rate, we are subject to penalties. Although we're not currently being penalized this year, we may be penalized if we continue to have if our error rate continues to grow. And so what we're hoping to do with this proposal is change some of the computer systems that we use for this to determine SNAP benefit amounts to more accurately track what we should be paying families and individuals. And these are changes to our systems that the counties and tribal governments have requested. We're also adding staff because the federal government suggested provided us with guidance that it would be beneficial to the state to add some staff in the SNAP system so that we can provide additional training, provide additional oversight for the counties and the tribal governments to make sure that we're getting our error rates down to at or below the federal or sort of the nationwide error rate level. So that's that proposal. There's several following proposals that have no fiscal impact. I can skip over those unless members want to hear about those. The next proposal is on line 160. This is a child care proposal.
I'm going to stop you there, Mr. Greenman. We have a question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greenman, We spoke at length about the SNAP error rate in committee previous to this, and I understand that there are potential sanctions that are pending in lieu of correcting this matter. We've heard about a 10% error rate in the testimony yesterday. It was averred that this has been the case for some time. Has anyone put pen to paper in terms of the dollar value of that 10% error rate in terms of what might have been leaking through the account? Have we made any assessment of that versus just the 10% error rate? Just put it in context.
Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I believe there has been some work done on that. I don't have that exact amount in front of me. I know that some of the errors have been in terms of providing too many benefits, and some have been in terms of providing too little in the way of benefits that then the person should have gotten. I believe on balance, it's probably erred on the side of providing too many benefits in the net. But we would have to get back to you with exactly what those amounts look like.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greenman, I think it would be important that assessment be provided to the chair and to the committee members that are pertinent to the assessment. I think it's important that we provide transparency in this matter and rectify it in a straightforward manner that everyone is aware of, and so that we can rebuild the confidence in that SNAP program for the benefit of all that are using it, and make sure that we're avoiding the sanctions as quickly as possible. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I know that you have other initiatives here about the uniformity standards that will hopefully also help counties look at eligibility and reduce the error rate, but also these old IT legacy systems, I think is also sounds like a problem that we really need federal assistance to invest and upgrade our IT legacy systems. Mr. Greenman, please proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair. Line 160, I believe, is in Representative Pinto's committee on Child Care Assistance Program retroactive payments. The next one on line 165, was originally part of the governor's proposal to refinance some general fund spending with TANF dollars that has been dropped. Then on line 171 is a reduction that we're taking on the Minnesota Food Assistance Program. This is a program that provides benefits similar to SNAP, but it provides it to legal non-citizens over the age of 50. And so we get an appropriation for this program, and the appropriation is essentially we're over appropriated for it basically. So we have too much appropriation and we don't spend as much as we don't spend all of it. So what this essentially would do is just reduce, make an ongoing reduction of about $700,000 a year in the appropriation, and that will allow us to continue to provide, fully provide the benefits for this population of people. Line 176 is, this is the proposal that Representative Schultz was just referencing. This proposal creates uniformity in the way we calculate benefits and eligibility for economic assistance programs. So this would include MFIP, general assistance, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, housing supports, and would also bring us into compliance with the SNAP program. So it would create uniformity, simplify things for the counties, make it easier for them to determine eligibility and calculate benefits correctly and streamline that process. It would also be more beneficial to the recipients in that it would, Minnesota is one of very few states, if any, I think we're maybe the only one that uses what they call retroactive eligibility or determinations, where we actually look back to determine somebody's income. What we would be doing, look back 2 months, I think, to determine somebody's income for the purpose of calculating benefits under this program. This proposal would have us look back at much more recent income in the last 30 days to project income going forward. And so that's called prospective budgeting. And that's what we'd be, that's what most other states do. And this would put us in line with those other states. It would also require, instead of monthly income reporting, it would only require reporting every 6 months when a family has income. So that would keep, one of the things that this does, one of the things that these programs experience, particularly the MFIP program, is we have a lot of people who drop off because the monthly income reporting gets to be a lot to do and keep track of. And so people end up dropping off the program and then going back on the program the next month. And so what we're trying to do with this is get people to stay on the program and if they're eligible. And so what this does is it does have a cost. It's going to take a while for the systems work to be completed. And so the cost in the first biennium is largely for systems work, and it's about $1.95 million in fiscal years 22 and 23. And then starting in fiscal years 24 and 25, I've got something in the way I can't see. It's about $80 million in fiscal years 24 and 25. I would note that of the spending on this proposal over the 4 years, about $32 million of that is TANF money. So this is eligible for TANF reimbursement. The next two proposals are both non-budget items, and so I was going to skip over those. Item on row 190 is a one-time payment for the Minnesota Family Investment Program. This would provide a one-time up to $750 cash payment to MFIP recipients in fiscal year 21 using TANF dollars. This would go out to the families that are currently eligible for TANF. We're projecting this to cost about $24.2 million one time in fiscal year 21. The next proposal is on line 195. This provides, as you may recall, in 2019, TANF benefit or MFIP benefits were increased for the first time in over 30 years. And what this proposal does, it was a $100 increase. What this proposal does is it actually builds in an automatic inflation adjustment based on the consumer product, based on the CPI. And so it automatically increases benefits each year to keep up with inflation. The cost of this proposal is about close to $9.9 million in fiscal year 22 and 23, and about $38.5 million in fiscal years 24 and 25. And
I'm going to have you pause there, Mr. Greenman. We have a question from Representative Robbins. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Yes, I'm interested in this proposal, particularly what your model is using for the inflation rate in the next biennium, but in the out year bienniums as well.
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe we're using the CPI, and I believe that's the same inflator that's built in and used for other. This is consistent with other programs that the department operates and that the federal government operates when they have inflators automatically built in to adjust the benefits. I'm not sure if that answers your question or not, but
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I assumed it was the CPI. Do you know what the actual number is that the government is currently using for the CPI in the current year? And then I'm just trying to see what they're projecting.
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that with me right now, but we can certainly get that and respond to that question for you.
And it may be in the governor's budget sheets too, Representative Robbins, the budget book. I don't know if you have a link to that. If not, I'll make sure you get that link.
Great, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Chair Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Greenman, you know, I absolutely love the idea of putting an inflation factor into MFIP, because everybody knows that it was many, many, many years without any sort of increase in this program. And then, you know, after like 30 years went by, we did a $100 increase. I mean, that shouldn't be happening. But the question I have has to do with the fact that the block grant itself doesn't ever get increased, right? And I just wonder what the, I don't have the fund balance in front of me, but the impact of these proposals, there are various proposals in the budget here that impact the TANF fund. And I can only assume that the governor's budget would not propose all these things if they didn't all fit into the fund. But is there anything that you know of in the American Rescue Plan that's going to help with this? Because I'm just really, I really am very interested in this program, but I also want to see it be sustainable.
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, that's a good question. Just stepping back a little bit about the TANF funds and the TANF fund balance, based on the February forecast, we have a TANF fund balance of about $79 million at the end of fiscal year 2025. What we typically do with that fund balance is we project spending it out or spending it down to zero at the end of the budget horizon. And that's we typically have a positive balance going forward, and then we spend it down. And then the next forecast, we do the same thing with the balance that we have. What we're doing with the governor's budget is spending down that $79 million on three primary proposals that I mentioned: the uniformity, the cash assistance calculation uniformity, this COLA proposal, and then the one-time MFIP benefits. That spends down the $79 million. After which there isn't that surplus anymore to help pay for things, and so presumably going forward, the general fund would pick up a bigger share of the costs outside the budget horizon. The American Recovery Plan doesn't, as you know, the support it provides is generally one time. And we do get a small amount, about $14 million in one-time spending, specifically to DHS for one-time non-reoccurring assistance. That funding is very similar to TANF. It's something that we could use for TANF purposes. So that's one piece of assistance it provides. And then of course the federal fiscal recovery fund that the state received, about $2.6 billion, that can be used to assist families who are suffering due to the economic impacts of COVID. So there would be some additional funding that could potentially be put towards those activities. But again, it's that those dollars are available until December 31st of 2024.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Chair Liebling?
Thank you very much for that. I won't dwell on this too much, except to say that, you know, I hope that the federal government is giving some thought to this block grant idea sounded nice long time ago. I think this might have been under the Clinton administration, and it was the big welfare reform, right? But to never expand this with inflation or anything else is just a travesty. And, you know, everything goes up, and we've had hearings about the cost of housing and everything else and what we still are expecting families to live on when they're on our Minnesota Family Investment Program, which, you know, one would think that when you're on that program that you would at least be at the poverty level, not way below it. So I'm glad the governor has included these things, but I just hope we can in the future be able to do better for these families? Because I don't know, you know, we just need to do better. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I will note to members and the public that there is a lot of support for the MFIP increase and the COLA, or cost of living adjustment, and index it to inflation. We have letters from Legal Aid and the Children's Defense Fund that were distributed to members and will be posted on our committee website, among others. So I encourage members to read those letters of support. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Mr. Greenman, when we talk about COLA and we talk about the CPI, I'm wondering, and this is probably something that you can respond to me at a later date, but I'm just going to put that out there, that in the narrative of economics, the CPI can tend to be one of the most volatile indexes that is tracked from a global perspective, given the variants that are used to calculate that number. So I'm wondering if you contain or maintain usage of the CPI, if you're going to use just the annual increase or the decrease, if you will, or if you're department is going to be utilizing some type of a smoothing technique or a 3 or 5 year average of the CPI to be a little more concerted and actually provide a little more continuity to any inflationary pressures that might be incumbent upon an economy in the short term, but not in the long term. Something we can take up offline, but I hope that your department is looking at that as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Greenman.
Thank you. I think that's an interesting suggestion, Representative Albright. I agree. The CPI can be a volatile measure, and I think we'd want to look at whether smoothing it out makes some sense. It's probably good for the recipients and you know, creates more of a great slope than a up and down kind of situation, which we don't want. One thing I wanted to do, I wanted to just respond to Representative Robbins' question about the inflation. And I don't know if this probably doesn't directly respond to your question, but what we calculated or assume is that benefits are going to go up in fiscal year 22 for families about $13 a month from where they are now. And then by fiscal year 25, we assume the benefits are going to go up on average from where they are now. They're going to be up about $65 a month. So the next proposal is maintaining family connections in foster care. And this proposal has a number of policy provisions, but the budget items mainly relate to we have a backlog of in our licensing division, which is exacerbated by the fact that we have such a growth in foster care licenses that folks are trying to get. These are largely family members who want to get foster care licenses to take care of their relatives. And what we want to do is make it easier for families to do that. And so one of the ways in which we're doing this is looking at some policy changes around family preservation and strengthening families, but also adding some staff to our licensing division to speed up the process of getting foster care licensure in place, and also to provide technical assistance to families as they're seeking licensure. This has a cost of about $1,150,000 in fiscal year 22 and 23, and then about $1,170,000 in fiscal years 24 and 25. The next proposal, which I believe is in front of this committee, is Row 208, and that would refinance some grants that were funded by the legislature in April, I think, of 2020 with general fund dollars. These were grants that went to childcare providers that were still open during the pandemic, wanting to just support them and keep them going and help them maintain compliance with public health standards. This would just essentially take the general fund spending, replace it with the coronavirus relief funds that we have remaining left over and reduce the general fund appropriation by that amount. So that would produce a savings to the state of about $23.6 million in fiscal year 21. The next proposal is a little more complicated. It's been revised since it was originally put out by the governor. It deals with behavioral health grant reductions. What we're doing here is we originally started with a number of reductions in grants. However, we've since made some modifications. Really, the only savings, there's several savings in this proposal, but the only reduction is taking $1 million from CD treatment support grants that are funded through gambling proceeds, taking $1 million that currently aren't being spent in those funds and just canceling them to the general fund as savings, and that's in fiscal year 21. In fiscal years 22 and 23, there's a couple of grants, children's mental health grants for first aid training, mental health first aid training, and then CD peer specialists. Those are funded out of the general fund. What we would do with these grants in fiscal years 22 and 23 is instead fund them with some one-time mental health block grant dollars that we have, behavioral health block grant dollars that we have. And so while we're taking the savings using general fund for that population, we are maintaining the grants at their current levels. And then starting in fiscal years 24 and 25, they would just continue with general fund spending in the base for those grants. We have on line 224, case management redesign. This is a federal compliance proposal. The state is under a corrective action by the federal government regarding our case management rates in the state. What we've been told is we need to have a uniform case management rate set by the state. What we have right now is a set of rates set by counties, and we need to develop a rate to come into compliance. And so what this does is it funds additional work that will lead up to eventually to a proposal in the 2023 session to set new rates, a new rate structure framework for case management. What this proposal also does is it provides funding to develop a rate, a targeted case management rate for tribal services. And the total cost of this proposal is $612,000 in fiscal years 22 and 23. And this is a sort of a short-term project. So there's no funding in the tails for this. On line 230 is our proposal that we had also back in 2019 to set create some uniformity in our mental health service standards. We have Mr. Burdick could cite chapter and verse of all the places where we define mental health and do it differently. And I don't think in any case is it ever accurate. I think our statutes are full of contradictions and inconsistencies around how we set standards for mental health services. So this is a big project to try to bring some uniformity, some common understanding to some very confusing statutes. And so this proposal would include a cost of about $500,000 in fiscal years 22 and 23 and about $430,000 in fiscal years 24 and 25. On line 238, I know this committee has heard several times from our staff about the waiver reimagined proposal. This would be phase two of that package. This has a savings or a cost of about $1.7 million in fiscal year 22-23. However, once we start implementing some of the pieces of this, specifically regarding individualized budgeting, we will start to accrue a savings to the state, and that savings amounts to about $7.1 million in fiscal years 2025 on a net basis. Then on line 248 is disability programs modifications. This was originally this makes a number of changes to our family foster care rate tier. It modifies the number of hours per day that somebody can be receive customized living services, and makes a number of changes related to disability services grants. So this has a number of provisions. The proposal has a net savings of about $16.9 million in fiscal years 22 and 23, and about $37.4 million in fiscal years 24 and 25. The next proposal is an EIDBI background study. This was, I think, discussed yesterday, if I'm not mistaken. This is just requiring EIDBI providers to get background studies and has a special revenue fund cost of $21,000, which is recouped through fees. And that's an annual amount, so there's no general fund impact. Line 260 is a proposal that has no fiscal impact. Line 262 is our combined homelessness proposal that we worked on with the Minnesota Interagency on Homelessness. What this does is it provides about $5 million in community living infrastructure grants that go out to counties and tribes to pay for services, support services to help people connect with housing and connect with the support services they need to help them maintain their housing. And then also emergency services grants. And this is funding that pays for largely for shelter space and for emergency housing for families and individuals who are homeless. We are also providing some additional funding for administering these programs. And then also one of the things we've noticed with one of our new housing programs, the housing stabilization programs, is that we've got a significant amount of interest in enrolling in that program to provide people with stable housing. We need additional staff we've got a waiting list right now. We would like to get rid of the waiting list so that we can get these people into housing and provide them with stability. So we're asking for two FTEs to help enroll people in the housing stabilization program.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. We have 10 minutes left, so I'm going to go to Representative Albright. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greenman, I'm looking at line 283 and then again on it's further down. What I'm looking at is the estimation for admin FFP on 283. It's at 32%. Further down, I think under min choices is at 50%. I'm wondering if you could elaborate for the members of the committee in terms of how that percentage is arrived at.
Mr. Greenman.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. Sure, it's partly the difference. Partly comes from the, as you can probably imagine, the underlying spending that we're doing, and the amount the federal government typically reimburses us, or the amount of federal funding that's actually available to pay for those services. We can draw down federal funds basically on a matching basis, depending on the amount, the level of federal funding for those particular activities. So like on line 283, what you're seeing is the average amount the state is able to draw down in terms of federal financial participation for administrative costs at the department. Our average is about 32%. Sometimes it's a little higher, sometimes it's a little bit lower, depending on the program. What we use a standard 32% and that funding goes into the general fund as non-dedicated revenue. So it essentially reduces the cost of the proposal to the general fund. The min choices amount is is the 50% is, this is a little bit different in that because it's a systems project, it it's money that it what it's what this is showing you is not savings to the general fund. It's showing you the state share of the cost of the systems work. We also draw down federal funds at a rate of 50%. So essentially the total cost of this project, for example, on line 253 is $30,000 in the first year. $15,000 is the state share, the other half is the federal share. And then it goes on from there. So you're seeing different, sort of different calculations depending on whether the state, whether the federal match goes to the state or whether it stays with DHS.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Representative Albright?
Nothing further, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Greenman, we have about 5 more minutes.
Okay, I'll be quick. The next item, line 272, is the self-directed union contract. This is the negotiations that with the collective bargaining agreement in it. This has some, a small change from what was originally proposed is some FTEs for cost reporting that will help us going forward better understand how costs are incurred and help us set rates. Going forward, this has a cost of about $68 million in fiscal years 22 and 23 and about $105 million in fiscal years 24 and 25. Line 285 has a disability grant programs reductions. We originally proposed some reductions in fiscal years 22 in these programs. Since then, we've scaled them back quite a bit. What you're seeing, the only permanent reduction in grants is well, one is to the State Quality Council, but that funding then is provided to provide support for the regional quality councils. And so the savings just is regenerated back into some new funding. And then some DT&H grants are permanently eliminated on line 290, as you can see. So the total savings from this proposal was about $5.7 million in fiscal years 22 and 23 and about $1.6 million in fiscal years 24 and 25. Then I'll skip back past the one on 293. On line 295, we use customized living unit adjust rates, the rate formula based on acuity. I think this one's been discussed in the committee in the past. The total cost in fiscal years 22 and 23 is $2.3 million, and in fiscal years 24 and 25 is about $7.6 million. We also have a proposal that would provide some rate reform for remote service provision to match the actual costs, because we use, for DWRS, we use cost-based reimbursement. So this what this these changes do is they reflect the lower costs providing services remotely. This has a cost of savings of $2.8 million in fiscal years 22 and 23 and about $6.9 million in fiscal years 24 and 25. And then the proposal that the testifiers were talking about on line 312, substance use disorder payment methodology, you can see the different, if you look down in the detail, you can see the different, the fiscal impact of the different components, but the actual impact is on the state level is a net savings of $15 million in 22 and 23 and about $32 million in 24 and 25. On line 322, there is a one-time appropriation in fiscal year 21 to the state to DHS for school-based mental health grants. This is coming through, I think, the Department of Education bill. There's the, you can see on line 328, the one-time appropriation to pay back the overpayments and the county share for the overpayments for tribal MAT and the county share for IMD services. And then the last two proposals, the first one is a operating adjustment for direct care and treatment. This was originally a little bit higher, but we're assuming some delays in staff and adding staff. And so the total cost is about $49.8 million in 22 and 23 and $57.3 million in 2024-25. And then the final proposal that's in front of this committee is a proposal that would create some uniformity in how we charge back to counties when somebody in our direct care and treatment program no longer meets criteria for the program, but it's still there. This would make our CABS program, which is serves children and adolescents with behavioral health problems, and I believe it's located in Wilmer. This would create a 100% county share if somebody's still there and the county hasn't moved them out yet. But this is the same that we do for all of our other DCT programs. And that's it, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. I am so impressed with your depth of knowledge, you know, being responsible for the fiscal spreadsheets, but also for all of these initiatives you just walked us through. So thank you for the overview. We really appreciate it. I know it's been helpful to me, and I'm guessing it's been helpful to the members and to the public. If you could stop screen sharing. And I just want to remind members that we are going to be meeting tomorrow morning at 10:30 to go over, I think we have 5 bills on the agenda. And then we'll be reconvening at 3 o'clock in a joint committee hearing with Chair Liebling's Health Finance Committee to go over the American Recovery Plan proposals that passed at the federal level to go over how they impact the HHS space and budget. So really appreciate Mr. Greenman and his entire team at DHS. Ever since I've come to the legislature, I've been so impressed with our staff, and I know they're going to be working even more than they work now. Putting together our omnibus bills, and just so the public knows, you know, they're contacted by 201 legislators and their staff, and they work with stakeholders and advocates across the state and their initiatives. So we have an impressive team all around, our staff, our agency teams. It's been great working with all of you, and look forward to working with you in the future. Representative Sandell, sorry, I just saw your hand. Do you want to make a quick comment or a question?
Oh, thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the overview as well. I have a quick question, and Mr. Greenman, if you can answer, great. If not, we can talk about it maybe later. Online, 324, when it talks about child mental health grants, you spoke several times about mental health, and I wonder how those grants are or how services are delivered for those grants. Can you talk about that, or should I talk to somebody else about that?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, I think we can have somebody else get back to you on that. I know that we have existing school districts that receive the grants, and I think they're delivered in the schools, but I'd rather have somebody else who's more knowledgeable maybe get back to you, Representative Sandell, on that.
Sure.
Thanks, Representative Sandell. Thanks, Mr. Greenman. So, members, again, thank you for joining us today, and appreciate the walkthrough from DHS. I'm going to lay House File 2127 as amended over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Oh, sorry, Ms. Fang. Ms. Fang?
Did you move the minutes yet?
Oh, we could do that right now. I believe we have a quorum. So let's see. Representative Bolden, would you like to move the minutes from March 24th?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
Okay, members. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those members in favor of adopting the minutes of March 24th, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and the minutes from March 24th, 2021 are adopted. So members, we stand adjourned. We will see everyone tomorrow at 10:30 and 3 o'clock. Thank you, everybody.